This is the real weepy and like tragic part of the story beginning, oh my brothers and only friends.
I'm in for four potential getaway drivers. Go.
No!
But I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
No!
Excuse me, we have a little bit of a hurry.
Hang on, Voltaire.
It's yet another long series of diversions in an attempt to avoid responsibility.
"'Tis a sad and somber day here at this just then. I'd only wish you could see the shameful expressions on our faces as we broadcast to you in a staggered, unpredictable interval. Even we are appalled at our conduct last week. If you recall, in our last podcast from January 16th, Tanner boldly proclaimed in his intro that we had put out three podcasts in a row and that, and I quote, we could just go an entire month without stopping. This, dear fans, was a bald-faced lie. I just knew we didn't have the resolve in us to commit to anything for, say, a few minutes. And I'd like to hear Tanner publicly apologize to our audience for it directly corresponded with an insane amount of email questioning where we were at last week. That, and I had to sort and sift through all of that. So stay tuned for Tanner's act of contrition later in the episode. All that aside, I'd just like to say that, true to our nature, we will never, I repeat, never put out a This Just In episode just for the sake of filling space. Instead, we pride ourselves on not podcasting if we have jack shit to say. So each time you click the link to the new podcast, just know that you're going to get a fresh, invigorating edition of This Just In. And also remember that we packaged it with care and took the time to think of things we could give to you, the listener, and things that we think you give a shit about. Today we have at least four really good topics with a 30% chance of ad-libbing. Now that's a forecast you can count on. As for your hosts, I'm Chris View, podcasting from Detroit.
And I'm Tanner Higgin, podcasting from Los Angeles.
And you sound so down. Wow, are you sad?
No, I'm trying to get rid of a chronic cough, so my voice is all messed up on medication and whatnot. So it's tough to sound really cheery when you've got all that going on in your lungs.
Yeah. Well, our first topic for discussion this week is something that's been bothering me a lot, which is this insane bout of writer's block I've been having lately. And I don't know what it is, but I feel as though I've run dry. Essentially, I'm just incapable of formulating anything of merit right now via, you know, the written word. And I guess when I do think of something, or when I think of something that is, I think is original, I realize that I start relying way too heavily on my sources of information for what I'm trying to what I'm researching or whatever, and I'm not relying enough on my own thoughts. And it's been really a disparaging few weeks because I have some ideas, you know, as to why it's happening, but at the same time, I don't know if I do know why I'm going through such a mental block. But first, I'd like to get an expert analysis from you, Tanner. So what do you think causes writer's block? Why is it affecting me to this degree? And furthermore, how long did it last?
Well, first, I'd like to explain that basically you're referencing our blog at the-means.com/blog.
Right.
And how you probably haven't posted in what, a month?
That's a lie. I posted on the 19th.
What did that post consist of?
It was about writer's block.
Yes.
It was about an interview that's going to be in the next issue that I'm going to be conducting with Mr. Stephen Pressfield, the hit author of such books as Gates of Fire, Tides of War, and The Legend of Bagger Vance.
Yeah, and yeah, so it's been a good solid month, and I'd like to personally thank you for making me look like some writerly superstar that I can come through every week with a post of decent size. Like I'm some super
welcome.
Genius.
I thought it was time to get, you know, change your shot.
Yeah, but I know you pretty well, and after thorough analysis, I've determined that there is one primary cause for your writer's block. And that,
okay, let's hear it.
And that is the simple fact that the only thing you read is Playboy. And not only do you not only read Playboy, but you don't even read it at regular intervals. You don't even read it next to a wood-burning fire with a robe on or anything. You read it while you're taking dumps.
Exactly.
And I think that could be the source of all of these problems.
Well, that's the all right. That magazine is—it's my hands down the best magazine out there. I encourage anyone Buy it for your children. Let them read it. Show them what it's like to actually have really good, you know, authorship in front of them. Because that magazine has nothing but great, interesting feature articles, amazing interviews. The writing is impeccable. And so, while I do read it at very staggered intervals, because when I go to take a shit, I rarely bring it into my room or into the living room to read. I mean, I think the other night I was perusing it with a friend of mine, but she and I were just basically evaluating women's breasts and not really...
Yeah, that's always a fun activity, is doing the Howard Stern evaluators on the pictures.
Yeah, because I had some critiques about this month's Playmate. But you're right. I think one of my biggest, one of the biggest difficulties I have is when I go to start reading a book, I've got about 6 books open right now, and all of them, I'm maybe 50 to 100 pages into them, but then I get to this point where it's like, man, I got too many books open, and I can't finish one of them, so I get discouraged, and I stop, and the source for any good author should be reading other people's stuff. And I know that basically when you do limit yourself to reading one source like Playboy or anything, you know, just any sort of magazine or whatever, your thoughts are, they become bent towards simply what's being said in the article.
And boobs.
Your horizons aren't necessarily... Yeah, that's true. you don't really get to broaden your horizons with other information.
That's one of the best things about graduate school is that it forces you to read stuff, you know. And I love to read, but when I wasn't in graduate school and I was just slaving away for the government, it seemed to be so hard to read. Not only because you're so tired all the goddamn time, but just because when you work 8 or so hours a day, you just want to hang out and do something stupid, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Not read, and it's so awesome to have reading be my job right now, and so I get to. You know, I get to consume a lot of different forms of media and, you know, get a lot of different cool viewpoints and have my mind expand.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah, well, because I've been in ruts before. Oh, I can't find anything original to say. But when you are forced to write, because that's how it was all throughout college, obviously, and even a little bit after college, I really was forcing myself to sit down, read a lot more, write a lot more. It felt like I had the time, but I think I know the initial source of my laziness began after issue 1 came out, because I felt as though we deserved a nice long break. And and so I took the liberty of granting myself one. And so we finished that. And I think the other thing is because, as I mentioned last week, my band just put out an EP, so we were working on that. And now that I've finished that, it's kind of like, yeah, you know what? I deserve another break. But time's not, like, this isn't the time for breaks, because we got issue 2 coming out, and, you know, we've got, what, thousands of people reading our blog a day. and surely they're all wondering where I'm at. I mean, I get emails and basically consisting of, you know, sobbing, and I'm sorry to all my fans out there a little bit more, but I just wanted to, I want them to understand I'm waiting for something substantial to hit me. So, if there's any hot muses out there, if there's any women out there who are just extraordinarily beautiful and want to give me inspiration, you can email me at chris@the-means.com. I'll give you my phone number.
Okay, well, I think we can move on to the next topic. I think it's safe to say we haven't come up with a solution, so don't expect a blog from Chris next week. The next topic was the Yes Men, which some of you may have heard about. I know I heard about it probably a year ago. It's this group of guys who are sort of corporate pranksters against, you know, globalization and neoliberalism and that sort of thing. They had made this documentary and they'd been in the news and whatnot, and I heard about it. I was thinking, oh, that's kind of cool, but I'd completely forgotten about them. And then on demand yesterday, I saw their documentary, so I decided to watch it. It turned out it was hilarious. It was way better than I was expecting it to be. And essentially, it's two guys with a group of a few other guys that help them out. And what they do in the documentary, they do a few other things, but they basically, they're imposters, and they impersonate heads of various globalizing evil organizations like the World Trade Organization or the World Bank and that sort of thing. And in the documentary, their main focus is impersonating heads of the World Trade Organization. and giving lectures at various professional conferences as heads of the World Trade Organization. Wow. And the best thing is, though, their lectures are essentially designed so that they're from the perspective of the World Trade Organization, but exaggerated. So they're believable, but completely outlandish at the same time. And the real aim of them is to, like, ease in. You know, they'll go up there, they'll start their lecture, and it'll be sort of normal, and then it'll get more and more bizarre, sort of lampooning the policies of the World Trade Organization, to the point where they expected people to boo them off stage or to throw things at them because their ideas were so ridiculous. But as it turned out, when they would go to these professional organizations, people wouldn't even bat an eye. And to give you how ridiculous their lectures are, an example, one of them was, they were like, okay, we've got this problem of globalized, you know, sweatshop labor. You know, and the big problem here is, how do we, as the powerful managers, you know, manage these poor people in these other countries? And they came up with this idea of the World Trade Organization suit, which was this gold suit with this giant phallus with a TV screen on it that you could walk around and watch your labor on this TV screen on this giant penis. And they actually went to a conference, presented this lecture where they started off in a suit, then ripped the suit off, and walked around in this gold suit with this giant penis explaining how this was their idea to solve this problem. And no one thought it was that odd. The impression I got from it was I was just so happy that there's people out there doing this stuff, you know, affecting this satire on these horrible organizations. You know, it made me so happy to see this.
Is it true that they proposed that as a way to solve global hunger, that they would have the poor eat hamburgers and then recycle them up to 10 times? Because I'm reading that right now on a site.
Yeah, one of their lectures is they have a partnership with McDonald's. The World Trade Organization has a partnership with McDonald's where they figure out, like, hey, you know, we got all these poor people starving. Why don't we feed them McDonald's and then come up with a system where we turn their shit into new burgers? It's called the Reburger. And they actually, in the movie, they present this to the college students, and, you know, different than the corporate heads and whatever, the college students were actually appalled and booed them off stage, which they were happy about that, to see, you know, that some people actually got it, you know.
That is amazing. Well, do they still do this, or is this kind of like an Ali G type thing where now that they're exposed, that these organizations know to look out for them, it's probably going to be impossible to get in anywhere? Or, I mean, are they going to continue this, or is it kind of done?
Well, they said they're shifting their focus from the World Trade Organization, but I'm pretty sure they still do this because I'm looking on their website, which is theyesmen.org, and they were on TV. I mean, this is the most amazing thing. They get on, like, CNBC and stuff as heads of the World Trade Organization talking about their policies and whatnot. And I'm looking on their page, and on the right sidebar, there's a picture of one of the guys on BBC World talking about the Bhopal legacy. So I'm assuming that's happened after the movie, because that was not in the movie. So, I mean, they're still at it, apparently.
And by the way, if you guys want to see the Golden Phallus, if you go to theyesmen.org, the link that says movie, or just go to theyesmen.org/movie. It looks like it's the cover of the box for the film. It's absolutely hilarious looking.
Yeah. So they're great guys, and I encourage people to check out the movie if they can, because it's great, and it's also, I mean, it's an intelligent way to educate people about the policies of the World Trade Organization and the World Bank. You know, really.
Given your current status as a high-class grad student who's got access to symposiums and what have you, do you think that at any moment you'll use the pulpit for these types of designs? Will you go up there with the intent of talking about neoclassicism or something and then end up discussing your gripes with the world? At what point will that happen?
See, I couldn't do it. And this is the most amazing thing about these guys, is one of them is a professor at, like, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute or whatever.
Oh, wow. Polytechnic Institute, yeah.
Yeah, and how, first of all, how this isn't illegal, and second of all, how he can keep his job while doing this, I don't know, because if I was to do something like this, I would assume that it would get me in a ton of trouble. you know, impersonating the head of one of the largest and most powerful organizations in the world. You know, I would love to do it, but I wouldn't be able to stop laughing either, because they can, I mean, they can keep a straight face, which is really good. The only time they couldn't was after that, after their Golden Phallus lecture. They had to have dinner with everybody at the conference.
Okay.
And the one guy was just sitting there, you know, and obviously he was tortured having to talk to these people. So the other guy came up to him and he's like, "Yeah, we've got a conference call with Mumbunku Ogato, you know, that's really important. We've got to go." And they just both started laughing. and they couldn't hold it in. That's the only time that they actually burst out in laughter. I mean, there's no way I'd be able to walk around that suit and not start laughing. So I wouldn't be a good yes man.
Speaking of infiltrating things, though, just really quickly, how great was it that I can't remember where it was, but that woman who, when George Bush was speaking to the crowd of people, and he had basically, they had loaded it with people in support of Bush, and be like, "I like you, Bush, you're an amazing person," you know, and they'd be like, "Oh, thank you," and then that one woman asked him a straight up question about why he signed the $19 billion cut in student aid or whatever, and he was so, like, he had no idea how to respond to it, because he wasn't expecting there to be someone who dissented in the room.
Oh, I didn't see that. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah, and she was like, she basically called him out on it, and he turned around and he's like, "Did I sign that?" He's talking to a guy that he's with. He's like, "I don't know if I signed that." You know, he had no idea. It's as though, you know, it's as though somebody just legislation across his desk, and he was just like, "Yep, gonna put my Hancock on that one," and just like $1 billion in aid to students.
I know, and that. But I guess that's just, I mean, when you're the president, you got to figure you're signing a lot of crap that you. I mean, it's impossible to know everything you're signing. And that's scary as hell to think that we've got a president who's just, you know, and probably have had a ton of presidents who just sign stuff without even taking a glance at it, you know?
Yeah,
you just,
I mean,
have your, you probably have your advisors look over it, tell you what to do, and then you just do it.
Yeah, and that's something I would expect, because obviously what's on your plate is huge, but then again, we're also talking about a guy who's taken a year's worth of vacation. I think that year could have been spent brushing up on whether or not he's going to cut, you know, the livelihoods of students. So, you know, I think really he doesn't have an excuse anymore. He's that dude who takes off of work every, you know, at least once a week, and, you know, I don't feel sorry for him.
Well, and when it comes down to it, I mean, education has got to be in the top three of every president's priorities. I mean, it's simple as that. Mm-hmm. Oh,
well,
and
education,
you know,
is wonderful society.
You know what I just figured out? I just was reading the website. The Yes Men is directed by the people who made American Movie.
No way!
Yeah.
American Movie is the greatest documentary. I will stand by it. I love it.
It's it is.
Documentary. So everyone who hasn't seen American Movie, go see that, and then I guess rent The Yes Men, because actually I'm going to go rent that today now that I know that it's out. Well, my lease is up in May, and so I've got so many thoughts and ideas of what I need to do, because I have 34,000 miles, almost 35,000. It's up in May. I drive a lot now, and so I'm worried that I might go over my miles, and I don't want to deal with that headache. So I'm thinking, do I buy the car that I own now, or should I go, or that I lease now, or should I go and try and lease another car? Which opens up an entire world of possibilities, considering how many car manufacturers there are, as well as how many cars in general. But as I've been doing this extensive amount of research on cars, I'm realizing that there are no cars out there that I give a shit about, nor do the car companies give a shit about me. And so, as I sit here almost daily pondering what car would suit me, what car best defines me as a human being, I realize that nobody has yet made that car, and furthermore, car companies, and I am speaking specifically about American auto companies, because, quite frankly, they're the ones who've been dropping the ball the worst as of late. It appalls me. I mean, on one hand, I don't want to buy it from, like, Ford or from GM based on how they're treating employees, you know, with all these layoffs and what have you. That's pissing me off, which I guess is kind of counterproductive, considering I should buy their car and then maybe they can hire someone with the money I pay. But the fact is, is their conduct has been reprehensible, not only in the employment side, but in the design of car side. And my brother's going to hate this because he's for GM, so I'm sure he'll take issue with this. But they've got this agenda to just push forth bullshit cars, yet they are light years behind Honda and Toyota and these other manufacturers who are actually like finding their niche in environmentally friendly cars and cars that are just designed well and well enough that you know you can own the car for years and not have many problems. And then there's other companies like Kia, who my brother will talk them down more than anybody by saying, you know, they're garbage cars. But I think to myself, if they were really making garbage cars, why would they put themselves in jeopardy by giving a 10-year warranty on their cars? You will not find that from any car company except for Kia. So they've got a 10-year warranty on these cars, which means to me, you know, they're either willing to foot a lot of money for repair parts, or they just don't need to repair their cars that often. Either way, I'm still covered, so that's fine by me. So, you know, there's that. But then I look at the GM fleet, and and I don't like any of the... Like, they've got the Chevy Cobalt. It's supposed to be for that, you know, it's for that 20-something just getting his foot in the door at his new career, you know? And it's not cool. It's not a good car. It's not that fuel economical. It's... they've got that one, and then they've got... shit, there's another car. It's the car I'm going to rent when I come out to L.A. to visit you guys. But, because it's cheap as hell to rent it, but it's this...
The Aveo? Small.
Yeah, the Aveo.
Yeah.
And, God,
horrible
is
car. Horrible yeah. car.
It's small as hell. I mean, so there's that whole issue. I guess I'm in a dilemma right now because I would love to like cars more. I would love to be a car buff. It would be fun, I think. Except for the other people who are car buffs. They suck. But... But I guess what I'm trying to say is, right now the state of the auto industry is in such ruin. It's in such collapse. I feel as though I'm pressured into looking at Toyota, and looking at Honda, and these other companies because essentially American car companies are just not up to snuff as far as I'm concerned. And in fact, I would like to reference a great article that was in last month's Playboy, I think, called Car Wars, and it was basically why Detroit is dying. And losing the battle, and it was a really thoughtful piece. I urge anyone who cares about the auto industry to read that. But what's your take on it, Tanner? I mean, you—I know you've only owned foreign cars. I'm pretty sure ever since I've known you, you had an Acura, and then you had the Volkswagen. So
well, I had a Mazda, which
that's what
it's
it was,
a foreign
yeah,
car,
yeah.
But it's very Ford-like, I guess. And because I guess they have similar plants and parts mm-hmm. and all that type of stuff. And then now I have a Volkswagen. But, I mean, really, growing up in Detroit, you sort of have a distortive perspective of the auto industry because everything is incredibly biased towards American automakers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously, Detroit is completely dependent on American automakers. So, I mean, it's understandable that people are very loyal. And also, I mean, GM makes up 4% of the GDP, I think it said in that play, which is shocking. You know, so it's important that American automakers do well, and I mean, there's nothing I would like more than them to do well. But as a consumer, I need to look out for this guy. And I mean, if anybody ever does the research into cars, you'll always come out with the same thing, and that's that Honda and Toyota are the most reliable and most fuel efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they have some of the coolest features. Like the Prius has got some of the most awesome technological developments in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think the overall trends just go to show that really, I mean, the American automakers have been out-designed and they made a huge mistake in the 90s in terms of they weren't investing in fuel economy and that sort of thing. They were trying to appeal to like the, you know, the Mustang driving crowd. And all of a sudden, mm-hmm. this war occurs, and China gets into the auto using game, and all of a sudden, you know, the fuel economy is an important thing, and they're left out to dry, you know? So, I mean, they're reaping what they sowed, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't argue that Honda Honda and Toyota are the best out there. The facts and figures are out there. I mean, now, finally, it looks like the American automakers are going to try to make their push to compete But it seems like it might be too late, which is really sad, you know. But if I'm going to go buy a car, I'm looking at Honda and Toyota because they're the best, you know.
You know, and I got in this argument with my brother a few months back. We were out to dinner, and it pissed me off because I could see the bias in him too, because he, you know, he's in the auto industry, and I don't want to say he's brainwashed. He just really likes his company, which is fine. You can enjoy where you work or whatever. But then it's like, now I see, you know. Now I hope he understands, because a lot of his best friends just got laid off. I mean, it's a disaster over here near the tech center. So many people are getting laid off, it's ridiculous. And but you could see that, you know, in his argument, what he was trying to say was that GM had been trying to push for fuel-efficient cars, that they were working, that they had a goal by, like, 2008, half their fleet was going to be, you know, fuel-efficient cars or whatever. But then I thought to myself, you know, that's pretty much bullshit, because if the technology exists there, they could be moving to do this right. They could do an overhaul right now, like get it done, and be on par with Honda or Toyota. Meanwhile, though, like Honda and Toyota have been exploiting the fact that these giant automakers in America are refusing to cater to the people like you and I, who but also don't really need a car that is like the fucking Canyon Arrow from that Simpsons episode. You know, I don't need a car that hogs four lanes. But that's what this auto industry has been doing lately, is they make these cars that are incredibly unreliant when it comes to their fuel economy. And they're just like, they're catering to the worst demographic of car buyer. And it's sad because, you know, they can make $25,000 for someone buying a Ford Explorer or whatever, and that's fine. But, you know, it just seems to me like it's kind of embarrassing that they would neglect this end of the demographic of people buying cars to such a degree that, you know, I will have to wait until 2010 for them to have a car that even compares to a Toyota or a Honda.
Yeah, and, you know? I mean, all they're doing right is, like that Playboy article pointed out, is like those Chrysler cars and, mm-hmm. like, the Dodge Magnum and stuff are doing really well because of the styling. But, personally, I hate that styling. I think it's horrible. And those cars, too, aren't fuel efficient. I mean, they're gas guzzlers, and they're all about horsepower. You still look at, when you sit around in Detroit and you look at the ads, it's all about horsepower. That's all anything's about. It's about horsepower and a car going over rugged terrain. And I don't care about that anymore. I moved out here. I mean, everyone drives foreign cars out here because people here have a real concern, number one, for safety, number two, for fuel economy, because that's the life out here, you know? And the simple fact that, the GM is planning on having fuel-efficient cars in 2008, Honda and Toyota have fuel-efficient cars 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, how far behind the competition do you have to be? I mean, it's just, it's sick, and it's sad that what's happening in Detroit is happening, that people are getting laid off, because it comes down to the fact that corporations are heartless and soulless. Anyone who thinks otherwise is absolutely wrong. They're heartless and soulless, and all they care about is the bottom line. And it's sad that everyone is so loyal in Detroit, and they don't keep this in the back of their heads, that this corporation will cut me off at the knees whenever they can. And that's what's happening now.
Okay.
And maybe finally now people are going to realize the nature of the beast. You know, you want to be so loyal to GM, but GM doesn't give a shit about you.
No, and if they did, I mean, testament to that is just the fact that they could... Oh, well, here, let me just bring this up, because I'm looking at it right now in front of me. But on Consumer Reports, if you go to consumerreports.org, they have... This is for used cars, but they have their Consumer Report good bets and their bad bets. Basically, cars that you if you're going to go buy a used car, they have a list of cars that have seemed to run the gamut and be pretty decent cars to buy, but then they also have ones that you should avoid. And a quick scan of the list, let me just read this to you. Basically, every Toyota model I can think of, the Toyota Tundra, Sienna, Sequoia, RAV4, Prius, Matrix, Land Cruiser, Highlander, Echo, Corolla, Celica, Camry, Solera, Camelon, 4Runner, all those are in the good bets. Same with almost any Subaru I can think of. There's one Pontiac. Okay, here's the American cars in this. There's a Pontiac Vibe. Lexus, I don't know where they're made, but I don't know if they're... Okay, there's, let's see. Who makes Infiniti? What's Infiniti? I can't even...
Infiniti and Lexus are the high-class versions of Honda and Toyota, I believe.
Okay, those are all on the list. So the only two... Okay, there's... Here we go. There's Buick Regal, Chevy Prism, Ford Crown Vic, Ford Escort, and then the ones that I read before, the Pontiac Vibe, and that was it. Those are the only ones on the list. The rest is Acuras. There's 5 of them listed. Honda, there's at least 8 or 10 that I see here. Mazda, there's 3 of them. Nissans, there's 4. Toyotas, there's like 12 or 14. Subaru, there's, you know, 5. Then you go to the bad bets. Then you see Chevy Blazer, Chevy Express 1500, Chevy S10 four-wheel drive, Chevy Trailblazer, Chevy Venture, Chrysler Town & Country all-wheel drive, Dodge Caravan all-wheel drive, GMC Envoy, Jimny, Safari, Savannah, Sonoma, let's see, Land Rover, I don't know, there's someone else, Lincoln LS, Lincoln Navigator, Oldsmobile, 3 of those, Pontiac Aztec, Pontiac Transport, Montana, Saturn View, and then the rest are Volkswagens or Volvos. But those are the... On their bad bets list, it's primarily American. On the good bets list, there's at least an 80% rate of foreign cars. You know, it's like an 80-20 ratio.
I mean, right before I left, there was an article in the Detroit News where they had, you know, the car of the year, and they named it the Civic. I mean, it's the Detroit News. If you're going to get a biased look on something, it's going to be the Detroit News car of the year. And the fact that they had a Civic was just like, wow. I mean, things have changed so drastically, and you can't blame the workers. You can't blame you can't blame the people that are just doing what they're told at GM. It's coming from you know, the top and their direction, and their direction has been so significantly flawed that they are now screwed. I mean, they are in deep shit right now, and it's
and
terrible.
Another thing that pisses me off, it's just bringing it up because you were talking about how it's from the top, and it starts up there. And okay, you know, I'm from a working union family, and obviously Detroit is a heavily unionized area, so I have union sympathies, and I'm in a union. So, but the fact is like one of the things that Playboy article brought up was the fact that people blame the union for high costs, especially like the healthcare costs, and that's bringing down these giant corporations because they have to foot the bill for medical expenditures for their aging or their retiring workforce. But that's bullshit, because then you look at how much the packages these CEOs are getting, and it's like 10 times more than what they're paying out for the blue collar guy who worked the line 30 years. Instead, you got, you know, a $5 million severance package, plus you know, basically he can go to any doctor in the world at any time and receive a new heart if he desires. You know, it's ridiculous. So all these people who are trying to say that, you know, the workforce is to blame for this, or that somehow the unions aren't negotiating the right way, it's absolute bullshit. And I wish people would just kind of get their heads out of their asses and realize that this is from the top down, and hierarchically the top is just a bunch of dudes who could give a shit about fuel economy, could give a shit about safety. What they really care about is if the fuel economy affects their bottom line, they'll think about changing it. But as of right now, it's not quite there, so they're going to keep making inefficient cars. That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's enough on cars. I hate cars anyway. I hate talking about them. I hate people who like cars.
It's a painful experience going to buy one, just because, I mean, they're so expensive and we're really not marketed to, and... Oh, it's just, you just get disheartened when you go out to buy a car. You're never happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's move off cars, though. Let's move on to a topic that always brings a smile to my face, racism.
Well, we're at 35 minutes. I think we should cut it off and save it for next week.
Really quickly, what was the thing going to be about anyway? Because all I've got written down is racism, so I have no idea how to even segue into that.
Well, I want to talk about... Well, I guess next week we'll talk about how something just clicked in my head during one of my classes, because I'd always been, obviously race has always been taught in schools is not biological, you know. I think everyone recognizes that it's not biological difference, at least every educated person does. I don't want to say everyone. But I had always been taught that it was a social construction, and then we were discussing in class how it's actually not a social construction, it's a political construction. So I'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting. I thought you were going to tell me that you suddenly became a race.
No, not quite. And
the magazine would plummet into doom. Yeah, so I guess that's it then for this week.
Yep, see ya. You have been listening to This Just In, recorded on Sunday, January 29th, 2006, and distributed on January 30th, 2006. For more information about this podcast and other projects, please visit www.the-means.com.
I'd also like to remind you that if you have favorite clips from the show, please email thisjustin@the-means.com with what clips you like, the date of the podcast they occurred on, and the general time frame that the moment occurs. Thanks for listening. And stop waiting for fate. This could be so great, but that's cliche.